during the last week, I think, pertains to the kinds of mapping projects that we have underway in our laboratory. And clearly, many of the speakers that you have heard and will hear this morning, and I'm not sure about next week, are members of the Laboratory of Neuroimaging, which is really quite a diverse and large group that does a variety of things, but much of the time depends heavily on the computational strategies that you've heard about. My task this morning, I think, is to try and provide you with a little bit of a sampling of the ways in which we can apply these strategies to better understand brain structure and function, both in a variety of species as well as a variety of subpopulations, whether they be healthy or diseased. And some of these slides you may have seen before from Paul or others, but perhaps I'll have some slightly different things to say about them. I think the challenge that we face in terms of applying these strategies is a way in which we can accommodate the differences in the source data. MRI, which has been probably the most dominant modality that you've heard about this week, is regularized in a way because of its tomographic nature and the fact that it's fairly simple in terms of dealing with. Other ways of which we can examine the brain may be destructive sampling, such as histology. It may be non-tomographic techniques, such as optical imaging. And each of these presents sort of a unique requirement for computational methods to accommodate into our multidimensional approach for examining these data in their native state. And so we have to try to not only take advantage of the information of each of these unique modalities, but place them into a reference system that allows a comparison, a contrasting, and ultimately an integration of these different techniques. And so as you develop these computational strategies, I hope you will continue to be sensitive about the differences of the source data. In our own laboratory, for probably the last 12 years or so, we've spent most of our time building the applications around an anatomic framework. It's the way neuroscientists communicate by the identification of neuroanatomic names. And atlases themselves are often based upon observations of anatomy. This can be done in a variety of ways. The slide on the left here is MRI. It's actually an MRI of a postdoctoral fellow who succumbed to 27 different scans. So we put him in the scanner a bunch of times and then took that data, registered it, and averaged it to improve the signal to noise. And just by something simple like that, one can greatly enhance the signal to noise that's available and hence be much more sensitive to subtle differences in the tissue types and the underlying differences that can perhaps discriminate different subnuclei or laminations and so forth. The slide on the right is postmortem. It's not of the same postdoctoral fellow. And it provides us with a much more detailed anatomic reference, both cytoarchitectural and ultimately chemoarchitectural information. And all one needs to do is place these data into the same coordinate system as our in vivo MRI, and then use some of these histological characterizations to better understand the source of signals that we're getting in the in vivo MR. And actually, in some cases, we have the very same subject, terminally ill subjects, that we've managed to get MR on. We also get the histology on. And so I think these are ways in which we can teach ourselves what these signals mean and better understand what it is that can be derived from them. Now, as you might imagine, the histology can provide us with much greater detail by zooming into these sections and digitizing them with optical microscopic techniques. We can get extraordinary resolution, but it comes at an expense of much greater data volumes. And so the computational strategies that work very well looking at a 256 cubed array of MR data, or 512 array of MR data, don't necessarily work well when one is dealing at this spatial resolution, somewhere less than a micron in X and Y and about 15 microns in Z. And although we don't typically do this on all of our data volumes, we have a number of them like this. And I think if you look at the trajectory of resolution that's occurred over the last 10 years, the ways in which we have to accommodate increased data volumes histologically are likely to emerge with other in vivo techniques. Now, atlases themselves have a particular role to play. Perhaps that hasn't been dealt too heavily in the last week, but I think one needs to understand some of the requirements or objectives of an atlas, and that is to relate a coordinate system to a nomenclature. Perhaps the most well-known atlas is the rat atlas. It was originally done by Paxinos and Watson in neuroscience. The rats were used and continue to be used a great deal to study neurophysiology. And the basic idea was to identify specific locations in the brain using bony landmarks as the origin, because in the rat, the relationship between the brain and the cranium is quite consistent, and the human it's not. And so one needs to identify an origin that is has utility for the application. So that's basically a pitch, roll, and yaw system, like in an airplane, and this provides us with a way to target specific locations with high degree of accuracy in the rat. Most rat atlases, however, were book published and never reconstructed into 3D, and were often made of multiple subjects combined together, so that if one did try to reassemble them into one common atlas, it didn't work very well. In a computational biology approach, such as we deal with, three dimensions is, I think, the minimum. So let's take a look at a variety of atlases that we in our laboratory have worked on. One of them is shown right here. This is the rat atlas that you just saw. And you'll see some white marks showing up here, which are the origin of these coordinate system. This is the 27 average of Colin Holmes. This is a histological data set from a macaque reconstructed into 3D. And this is a high-field MR, 11.7 Tesla MR, of a particular mouse, which is heavily used in the genetics community. It's called the C57 black mouse. And I'll show you some more data on that. And I think all of these things, besides their entertainment value in these animations, I think each of them, number one, are different species, which have their own requirements. And number two, they're different modalities and have been collected in a different way, which have their own requirements. So as one thinks about the computational strategies for making models and measurements of these data, you have to accommodate both different species differences as well as the different modalities. Now, in a multimodality atlas where one might, I don't know if you can dim the lights a little bit, is that possible? If one takes a look at the different kinds of observations that can be combined, each of those, as I mentioned, provides a unique perspective on the anatomy or physiology of the tissue. But one needs to be able to combine those in a way to have a sort of integrative, a comprehensive view. And that using an atlas construct, as long as they're placed into the same space, one can equate MR observations with Nissl stains, for example. These are histology. This is a cryosection block face, and this is a myelin stain, all showed relative to the delineations of the center section. By doing that, one has the ability to compare and contrast the different types of observations. But it requires some kind of interface. Many years ago, I think this was perhaps done by Ivo Dinov, who you'll hear from later today or this week. He developed an interface where one basically just has the ability to look at different locations within the brain. You can call up different modalities. Now we're in the histology section, and relate the location of this either by a name structure in this brain tree type construct, type the name as you just saw, or relate them using a coordinate system as shown here. So the basic idea is you always know where you are, that the atlas knows where you are in three dimensions and has information about that location. The information is not only the name as shown here, but other information that may be linked with an HTML type service. We often need to make measurements in 3D, as you've seen emphasized during the last week. And I think the morphological type of characteristics, whether they be shape, form, orientation, surface complexity, volume, and so forth, all of these types of things are critical and often require a defined explicit geometry in order to make those type of measurements. And so we've done this in a variety of rodent models, from the mouse to the rat, which you'll see here. This is the rat. Because we have explicit geometry of all of the underlying structures, such as being illustrated here, we can then alternatively sample those in a plane different from the way they were reconstructed, and not only in an orthogonal way. So we can take oblique sections, such as being illustrated here, which allows comparison to another data set that may be collected by another experimenter, who often don't have the same plane of section as you might have. This is a series of experiments that we did in collaboration with Marianne Martone at UCSD, where we took the C57 BL6 mice. The previous little sequence showed you the high-field MR. Then we did the histology, identified the structures such as shown there. We took the sections, flattened them, cytochrome oxidase, optical microscopy, then two-photon microscopy, all the while keeping track of where we were in three dimensions. Ultimately, these data set got imaged in a high-voltage electron microscope so that one can zoom down to an individual spine, dendrite with their spines on it, and then reconstruct those, all the while keeping track of where we were. So this is a rather dramatic demonstration of migrating from a centimeter scale down into a nanometer scale. Now, that's not to say that we can survey the entire brain with this degree of spatial continuum, but it does provide, I think, an example of the utility of keeping track of where you are so that you can accommodate different types of observations, not only in different modalities, but different scales as well. So how to put all of this together? So this is a project that was undertaken about 2.5 years ago. It's called the Mouse Atlas Project. Alan McKenzie is chief of that in our laboratory, and it's a way in which we can accommodate not only these different observations and the atlas constructs that I've illustrated to you, but also to provide a useful framework for the measurement of gene expression data relative to anatomic models. And so the notion is to be able to take data from multiple sites. These are all different laboratories, different modalities. This is gene expression data, histology, high-field MR. Some of this comes from Caltech and Russ Jacobs. This comes from UC San Diego, and this comes from our laboratory. Register all these data into a common coordinate system, and then use a variety of viewing tools, some of which you're going to see later this morning, developed by David Shattuck, who will illustrate the power of some of these techniques here, which allow a very seamless interaction with all of these different modalities coming from different sources, all relative to atlas templates, which also may come from different sources. Anatomists, as you may know, have different perspectives on the identification of structures. They often argue about what's what, and therefore one can call up different templates to identify the structures within this atlas construct, including different modalities. And of course, one can relate those to other web sources that may be available. This is a pipeline environment, which you'll also hear more about from David Rex, who's the author of this. This, I think, is one of the more powerful techniques to allow us to not only perform the sometimes complex sequence of programming steps necessary to take data, process it in a way, place it into the Atlas construct, and then make some analytic decisions on it, but it also allows one to accommodate different modules that come from different sources, and he'll describe that in far greater detail, so I won't belabor that. This is an example of him taking a 450 subject average, processing it through a series of steps, which my guess is you'll describe in much greater detail, and producing an average such as illustrated here. So again, I won't belabor that, but I think this is a demo that you'll be able to see in the laboratory. It's software that's given out, and I encourage you to take that and try to use it. You'll find it very potent even if you have your own software. And then finally, this is the next evolution of that approach, which David has developed a brain extraction meta-algorithm where you have parallel processing streams all looking at the extraction of brain relative to cranium so that one can make decisions on a voxel-by-voxel basis as to which algorithm gives you the best result, and then have a much more accurate product of that. And I think you'll hear much more about that in a little bit. Now, as I mentioned, I think the notion of defining where you are in the brain and what structures you're looking at is something that's extremely important as you go through the modeling process, that we need to be able to communicate by neuroanatomic names. This is often done by the application of templates, which have these delineations already established. Perhaps the most commonly used in the human brain mapping world is Tallarak and Tourneau. The Tallarak Atlas is, for many reasons, incomplete and insufficient for modern-day computational anatomy. And so lots of folks have worked hard at trying to develop much more detailed templates for the identification of structures in the human brain. This is one that was developed by Jacopo Anis in our laboratory, and it defines many structures in much greater detail than one might find in other published atlases, and once again, this is available on the web for you to download. And here you see some subnuclei of the thalamus to illustrate the degree of detail that's available there. Historically, we've used a variety of atlas templates. This is the Brodmann template, which perhaps you're all well familiar with, around the turn of the century. And it was based upon cytoarchitectural details, looking at patterns of cell type and density to identify regions and then infer their functional responsibilities by these characterizations. One can relate modern computational anatomy to this merely by taking the fluid warping approaches that Paul has illustrated earlier this week and applying those so that these cytoarchitectural maps of Brodmann can be used to identify modern neuroanatomy. This work was done by Paul Razer and Philip Ward in Australia in collaboration with Paul, and I think it's sort of a nice way to combine the historical identification of structures with modern computational anatomic approaches. Again, in terms of the analysis of data relative to atlases, the cortex has perhaps received the most attention primarily because the functional maps that we're so interested in concentrate on the cortex. There are many ways one can measure cortex. You can look at the thickness of it, and this has also been discussed this week, or these kernels, as Paul probably spoke about earlier. And I think these approaches, each of which provide you with a perspective of measuring gray matter characteristics, each with their own assumptions and advantages and even limitations. These processes can be conducted over time and correlated with other types of measurements, whether they be IQs or drug effects or any other type of measurement that occurs over time, and generate four-dimensional maps, which perhaps can be more sensitive to disease processes than static or single-time shots. This is a map of gray matter loss of Alzheimer's disease developed by Paul, and it's an average of about 50 subjects, which shows you, which I'm sure you've already seen, the heterogeneity of gray matter density across the cortical mantle of these subjects, which I think provides a signature, if you will, of this disease process and ultimately may be useful in characterizing it in its earlier stages and perhaps make it amenable to prophylactic therapies. This is a map that shows the difference in cortical modeling between a normal elderly subject and an extreme case of Alzheimer's disease. And I think as you saw that animation run from a normal-looking brain to one that has a rather devastating effect of the cortical thickness, you can appreciate the morphological changes just by looking at a quick animation such as that. This is a although you can't see it very well in this light, this is a probabilistic map developed by Ivo Dinov of about 30 subjects of Alzheimer's disease. You're looking at the highlight of frontal lobe and underlying white matter at the 50th percentile. And so I think you can immediately recognize the clinical utility of having a probabilistic representation so that you could compare and contrast individuals with that distribution. And again, looking at a series of time scans. This again is work by Paul Thompson, and we're looking at an average of 17 subjects over a period of 2 years, average age of 68, moderate Alzheimer's disease. And you could look at the sequence of events that lead up to changes in cortex as the density of cortex changes over this relatively short period of time, only 2 years, and appreciate the fact that the more serious results originate in these limbic structures around cingulate cortices here and then sort of propagate outward. This is a project done by Nitin Ghodke in collaboration with a number of folks in our laboratory, and I think this shows a rather dramatic lifelong change of cortex over a period of 5 years to 20 years, looking at the repeated scans in a longitudinal way every 2 years. And so this group of subjects shows once again the fact that there are dramatic cortical changes that occur in lifespan of these relatively young subjects, and that higher order areas perhaps mature earlier than somatosensory or visual regions, and that phylogenetically older areas may mature earlier than newer ones. And this is not necessarily a new observation, but one that's confirmed by looking at these MR models. So here's a movie of that, looking at both left and right pattern of it, and you can see the changes that occur over this life cycle accelerated over a period of just a number of seconds. This is work by Elizabeth Sowell, which again looks at a life span of changes in the cortex, and this is a cross-sectional study as opposed to the study by Nitin and Paul and company, which was a longitudinal study. But once again, it has the same kinds of results where we see regional differences of cortical change, cortical gray matter loss, in different regions of the brain. And if you look at these two regions that are plotted here, this is the superior frontal sulcus, the superior temporal sulcus shown here, you'll see two different patterns. One where earlier in life you have a rather accelerated gray matter loss, which then sort of plateaus, whereas in this region you have a plateau earlier in life, but as we get into this end stages of life, it accelerates in terms of gray matter loss. So you have not only a dynamics in terms of the location, but dynamics in terms of the rate. This is a quick movie that just sort of shows you that accelerated. I won't belabor that. And this is a sequence of these plots measured by Elizabeth's work over the entire cortical mantle shown here. And then we can model this in two different ways. One by making explicit geometry of the brain, and the other by looking at the gray matter loss maps that you've just seen in the previous movie. So here's first the gray matter loss maps shown. This is gray matter thickness as opposed to loss, so you're seeing the age trajectory here, and you'll see regions that have decreasing thickness as one gets older in a rather specific region of the brain. Can't remember where this goes. Okay, so here's a comparison between the movie you just saw, looking at gray matter thickness, and one where the explicit geometry is modeled younger than this group into 6 months of age, and then you can begin to see that the brain stays about the same in the middle life periods, but then changes rather dramatically later in life, as we know. So there's a variety of ways we can model the brain using tensors. You've seen some of that perhaps by Paul. This, I think, provides us with not only a unique way to measure some of these local changes, but also has sort of an aesthetic appeal to it as well, so that just looking at these tensors colored, you can immediately appreciate both regions, degree of difference, and orientation of differences that occur in these different populations of subjects. These techniques, I think, are only beginning to emerge, and there are a variety of ways that I think they can be enhanced both visually and statistically to improve our sensitivity in these populations. So this is an area that I wanted to show you because I think it presents a challenge. We haven't done a great deal of work in terms of modeling vascular anatomy. Vascular anatomy is extremely important because it is the basis of much of our measurement of functional anatomy. Much of what we measure in terms of the location of active circuits involves hemodynamics. And yet, it's very difficult for us to make models of these vascular systems. This is postmortem brain tissue collected at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility in Grenoble. We're looking at about 1 millimeter cubed, as you just saw, panning up and down, and then volume rendered using a mirror to examine single vessels, as shown here. And I think that increasingly we're going to have to better understand the relationship of these functional maps with these vascular anatomic maps. This is a venogram, which we can collect on a routine basis with MR. We can collect, let's see what's happening here. We can collect these time of flight measurements, looking at the aortic arch or the neck as shown here. And these kinds of models immediately appear amenable to the morphological modeling that we have used in brain parenchyma. And so I think this is a new opportunity for us to better understand the relationship between brain and vessel, and to perhaps understand the relationship between that and functional anatomy. One of the ways one might do that is to use the same type of technique as this cortical model you're seeing illustrated here with a CA1 pyramidal cell, that one can take the sort of a skeletonized approach to identify vessels that we can obtain in vivo MR to characterize the degree of branching and bifurcation and patterns that are available in these vascular systems, similar to what can be seen in these vessels, such as illustrated here. So this is work by Ascoli, who's been collaborating with us, and we've sent him some of these MR angiographic images to try to encourage him to make these three-dimensional models using a skeletonized approach so that we can gain some statistics and parametrics on them relative to their anatomy. So I have one or two more little slides here. This is a movie which I like to show because, number one, it's entertaining. This is a movie that we're working on in our laboratory for educational purposes. This is being used as part of an NIMH project to educate high schoolers and young college students about functional imaging and mental health. And I think as we go forward, it's important for us to encourage young students to get interested not only in the computational strategies that you focused on this week, but perhaps using those to better understand brain structure and function. So in my 22 minutes or so, I think I've given you a rather whirlwind tour about a variety of approaches in terms of the computational strategies that can be applied, both in different modalities and different species and for different populations. Clearly, this is only the very beginning. I would encourage you all to think about ways in which you can integrate these different measurements and data types into a more common framework that allows us to perhaps establish correlative relationships between the observations and data types. And with that, I think I'd like to close and thank my laboratory and you for your attention. Thank you.